Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, it's a look at a major piece of legislation which would overhaul Pennsylvania's election system. Also, why is the red knot population plummeting? The iconic shorebird's numbers along the Delaware Bay were disturbingly low this spring. But to begin, according to the National Cancer Institute, black men are more likely to develop aggressive prostate cancer than their white counterparts, and twice as likely to die from the disease. Concrete reasons for the disparity are unclear at this point, and a five-year NCI study into environmental and genetic factors as they affect black men is underway. But in the meantime, the message from medical experts is clear. African American men need to be especially vigilant about prostate health. For former Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, this is a story that hits home. Nutter had surgery for an increasingly aggressive prostate cancer late last year. And today, health restored, he's working to get the word out about the importance of screening for black men. Mayor Nutter joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Hello and welcome.
Thank you, Mary. Good morning to you.
Good morning. So let's start with your story. When did you first decide to get screened for prostate cancer and why?
When I was thinking about your intro, I mean, all men should generally get screening after the age of 50. It was only recently, quite honestly, that I learned more about the disparities as it relates to black men. And generally, the recommendation is over 40, if there's a family history, and at least by 45. For black men. So, I mean, I'm an advocate for all men, but as a black man, I'm, and knowing these disparities, I'm particularly concerned. So, I mean, with all of that said, I had started getting PSA screenings at the recommended age, 50 plus, and had, you know, been monitoring with, you know, fairly regular checkups. Probably was not the most perfect in terms of getting to the doctor on a regular basis, but fairly regular. For any number of years, there was no sign of anything. After not going to the doctor for a few years toward the tail end of my term, just, you know, any number of the usual excuses, too busy, don't have the time, you know, I'll get to it soon, all of that. In 2016, finally getting back to the doctor, we did notice an increase in my PSA number, which, you know, is always a concern when there's an increase. Yeah. It was not, you know, in a danger zone. And, you know, the general three options that are accepted are, you know, what they call active surveillance, radiation, and then, of course, surgery, prostatectomy. I chose active surveillance. You know, that's just, you know, you're really just monitoring things, nothing else for you to really do. Again, it was not in a particular danger zone, but of concern, I would say. Excuse me. A couple years later, 2018 or so, noticed more uptick, I guess you would say, or an increase in my number. Not dangerous, but
concerning.
More concerning.
Yeah,
more concerning. And then in 2020, got another PSA test. This was after having been in a hospital for emergency appendectomy. 2020 was quite interesting in that way. You know, obviously even more devastating for any number of other people. So I'm not even, you know, comparing. As someone who, you know, I hadn't stayed in the hospital, been in the hospital for myself since I was 17, you know, that was a different kind of experience. But after the appendectomy and, you know, full recovery from that, I said, you know, you really need to get back on this, what I'll call this other thing. You know,
yeah.
You had this other thing, right, which really could, you know, kill you. I mean, you know, appendicitis is pretty dangerous, but, you know, that was taken care of pretty quickly. And so I had another PSA, and that test, you know, I might say, you know, I didn't have to be Marcus Welby to figure out that, you know, that was a bad number.
Okay.
And, you know, very high. And, you know, I just kind of looked at my doctor. He looked at me, and I was like, okay, you know, we need to move to the next level here.
So, at what point did you bring your family into the conversation?
was regrettably pretty late, which was the worst possible thing to do. But I, you know, I guess there were a couple of things going on in my head. One, I've always kind of been a believer in, you know, don't bring a problem if you don't have a solution to go with it. I wasn't ready for a surgery. Quite frankly, I just wasn't really ready to fully accept, you know, where I was. I mean, I knew what my diagnosis was. And I know there's a, you know, a course of action or a course of care you can take, but I just, you know, didn't really want to come to grips with it, to be brutally honest. And it's not like it's going to go away, and you're going to have to face it at some point. But I just, my head wasn't in the right place. Talking with my doctor, he introduced me to a surgeon. Met the surgeon, seemed like a good guy, well experienced, did a little research. And so when I talked to my family, it was, you know, really kind of, this is my situation. We've been watching it for some time. It's now at a point where I have to take action. Here's my name of my surgeon. This is our course of action. I've got a surgery date. This is the deal.
So you had successful surgery in December. Life-saving?
Yeah.
Life-saving, in your opinion?
Life-preserving? I mean, yeah, life-preserving. Yeah, yeah. Again, I don't want to give the impression I was on, you know, death's doorway or something. But, you know, it goes back to your intro. Left untreated, it will kill you. So, you know, I finally came to grips with that. And so when I got my number, basically it was like, look, you know, it's like the conversation in my head. Look, dude. You need to do something. And if you want to be around, if you want to do all these other things, you know, be involved and be active and be engaged and be with your family and your friends and enjoy, you know, these, you know, what I would say later years in life, you have to do something.
So there might be a number, there are a number of issues surrounding being tested, being screened, you know, the surgery that might put some men off. You know, there's the screening, which, you know, itself involves, frankly, a digital rectal exam, might be a little bit uncomfortable. Some men might be put off by this. Also, the prospect, you know, of the potential side effects of surgery, potentially incontinence or sexual dysfunction. Yeah. What would you say to those who might put off screening because of these factors?
Well, you know, I think at the end, and I'm not being flippant, Mary, you know, living just beats dying. And I think the quality of your life is really, really important. You know, you may or may not, everybody's different. Everybody's body is different. Everybody reacts differently. And, you know, when it's caught, you know, what stage you're at, or, you know, mine was, you know, pretty preliminary, but, you know, becoming more aggressive as your intro indicated. So, you know, I mean, there's living and then there's living, you know, and early detection, knowing your number, figuring out what to do, what's your course of action, and then taking action is just the best thing to do. You know, nobody lives forever. I know I'm going to die at some point. Okay. You know, I get that. But I want to have as good a quality of life until whenever that time comes. And if there are things that I can do individually to protect myself, lengthen, you know, my time here, you know, have as good a quality of life, you know, walking, talking, thinking, doing, then I needed to do that. And for me, it was really that kind of final moment or realization or thought that, you know, this could kill you. Yes, there could be some challenges going forward, but you will be alive and you'll be around and you can still do stuff.
That
just made it all crystal clear for me.
Just want to jump in quickly about the PSA test, which, you know, it's been controversial in recent years.
Yeah.
There are concerns it can alert a physician to the presence of cancer, but the test can also lead to false positives, you know, maybe overly aggressive treatments.
Sure.
What are your thoughts about the PSA test?
Yeah. Sure. It's an indicator I guess the day that somebody develops, you know, the perfect test for virtually anything, you know, will be, you know, might be the first, right? So it's one test. It's an important test, but it's one test. So get the PSA. What does that involve? It involves the same thing that, you know, if you wanted to get your, you know, cholesterol checked or, you know, something else. I mean, the basic, it's a blood test. Right. And yes, there is the exam, of course. Slightly uncomfortable. It's over pretty quickly. Right. Very quickly. So get the test. You get a number. If there's a concern or if you, you know, if you want additional information, there are other tests. You know, there's an MRI. There are a variety of other tests that can, you know, figure out more definitively, you know, what might be going on. I had my PSA, and, you know, there's a biopsy, right? So, I mean, now it's not just, you know, what does the test say? Now we're talking about a biopsy and, you know, some tissue for analysis. So, I mean, there are a lot of things to do, a number of things at least to do before you get to, you know, surgery or radiation. But so every one of my tests were consistent. You know, the PSA was showing, you know, the number was going up. The biopsies were showing that there were, you know, cancerous cells, small number. Again, not life-threatening. It wasn't like I was going to, you know, fall out the next day. Yeah. But every step along the way, you know, these different tests were ringing true.
So one step at a time. But
one
take
step at a time,
the first step.
See what your options are, but take that first step, yeah. Right? I mean, knowing, you know, again, we can fool ourselves, you know, I would say, you know, starting with myself, you know, speaking very, very generally, you know, men have an enormous capacity to ignore things, you know, related to our health. That's a very general statement, and I apologize.
We all do, I think.
So you can tell yourself, you know, hey, I know I seem to be urinating more, but, you know, yeah, I've been drinking a lot more water or whatever, right? You know, there are all these little signs along the way that you can ignore.
But don't.
You can try to ignore getting the information, right? But at the end of the day, you actually really do want to know. There's a small part of you that is wondering, if I can say on WHYY, like, what in the hell is going on here?
Yeah,
right?
That's just fine.
So do the basics, right?
Quick question for you.
Get the exam and see where you are.
We only have about 20 seconds left, but, you know, because of history, there's a reluctance among many in the Black community to trust the medical establishment. Now we've got about 15 seconds. What do you say to that, Mayor Nutter?
Talk to your own doctor or find a doctor that you know, respect and appreciate, and then listen to what they say.
All right. Former Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, so good to have you with us on the Regional Roundup some really important information, and take care.
You do the same. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Coming up, we're going to talk about some legislation being proposed by State House Republicans in Pennsylvania, which would overhaul existing election rules. We'll hear from the Philadelphia Inquirer's Jonathan Lies. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The general election of 2020 was held just over 8 months ago, but the controversy generated by then-President Trump's refusal to accept the results remains a factor in efforts to revamp Pennsylvania's election system. Republicans in the State House have introduced new legislation which would require significant changes, including mandatory voter ID at the polls, a requirement that mail-in ballots undergo signature verification, and new regulations around ballot drop boxes. And even though there are provisions which will likely appeal to Democrats, the proposed Voting Rights Protection Act was crafted without input from the minority party. So will this broad overhaul of Pennsylvania's election system gain traction in the full General Assembly? And if it does, how might Governor Wolf respond? Also, what is the likelihood any provisions of the legislation will be in place before the general election in November? Here to discuss the particulars is Jonathan Lai, the Philadelphia Inquirer's data and democracy reporter, and he joins us now. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So at first glance, this legislative proposal seems to be a mixed bag with some proposals that are, you know, probably non-starters for Democrats. Let's get to some of the bigger sticking points first. Jonathan, as you report, Republicans want stricter voter ID rules. Why do they say this is necessary, and what are they asking for?
You know, voter ID laws have a long history over the last decade, both in Pennsylvania and across the country. In Pennsylvania, the Republican-controlled legislature did pass one of the nation's strictest voter ID laws about a decade ago, but it never took effect and a court struck it down. So since then, Republicans have consistently said, we need strict voter ID laws. This is an idea that this will prevent against fraud, right? There are a lot of ideas. People worry about fraudulent voting. Now, you know, we should be really clear here and say that that just doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Sure, you have a case here or there, but we just don't get that very often. But still, you know, it remains a bit of a boogeyman for some people. And for others, they see it as a bit of a loophole that they can close.
So this proposed legislation would require all voters, not just first-time voters, to provide ID at the polls, correct?
That's right. In Pennsylvania right now, you really only have to show ID if it's your first time voting or it's your first time voting in a precinct. So, for example, if you move across town or you move to a different county within the state, this would take that requirement and apply it to every voter.
And what sorts of ID are we talking about? Driver's licenses? You know, what if you don't have something like a driver's license or a voter registration card?
Yeah, so even right now, there are options. You can use a driver's license. There are other options under this bill, which, you know, again, it's a Republican bill. No Democratic input on this,
yeah.
But this bill would allow things like other government IDs. If it's a student ID that has your photo and has some dates on it, you can even sign an affidavit to say this really is who I am. So there are other options around it. And also, this would require every county to give voters an ID.
There is real concern that this could disenfranchise voters. How so?
You know, every election change that you make can disenfranchise voters. Voter behavior is really complicated. And when it comes to something like voter ID, the thing that we have to be really careful about is it can be difficult for different people to have access to those IDs. So what we know is when it comes to government-sponsored IDs, voters with disabilities, older voters, poor and low-income voters, they're the least likely to have best access to these IDs. Now, what the Republicans would say is that's why we want to give them out to every voter when they register. That's why we would require this kind of new ID to be given to everybody. But that's a concern. And other things like that, you know, nothing is evenly applied across all voters. Everybody's in a different situation.
What are the odds this provision is enacted while Governor Wolf is in office?
Well, even before... You know, nothing has a 0% probability and nothing has 100%. And Harrisburg can surprise us. You know, Governor Wolf, who's a Democrat, said even before this proposal was unveiled that he is not going to stand for any sort of strengthened voter ID requirement. You know, that's a Democratic position and he has final approval, right? Over any legislation, the governor can approve or veto. So that does give him negotiating power. Now, the question is whether Republicans will be able to bring in enough of these other provisions to negotiate some sort of compromise with the governor.
Let's get to signature verification. Why are prominent Republicans asking for a verification on mail-in ballots? And does the election infrastructure, Jonathan, have the bandwidth to support this, you know, especially in an election in which millions of votes might be cast?
You know, this comes back to the same sort of general framework with voter ID. Republicans tend to focus on ideas of election security and integrity, and Democrats tend to focus on accessibility of the ballot box. And this is a really good example. When it comes to signature verification, a lot of Republicans look at this and say, hey, if you vote by mail and you don't have to sign it or you don't have to do anything, how do I know that it came from the voter versus somebody else? Now, the infrastructure problem is a hard one. I mean, this is true not just for signature verification, but for basically any change you want to make with elections.
Sure.
Elections are chronically underfunded for a long time. Our infrastructure is very old, but it's rapidly new in the last 2 years. And this would make all sorts of new changes. And one of those changes would be that when you run these ballot envelopes through these ballot extractor machines, you know, that cut open the envelope and pull out the ballots, that they would be required to have some sort of system for comparing signatures as they go.
So some sort of system. In other words, there's nothing in place at this point that could do that.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you should say that. There is a requirement under law that all mail ballots have to be signed. But last fall, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said you cannot compare the signature on the ballot to the signature on file because there would be all sorts of problems with the idea that are the people trained? Can you do handwriting analysis? Like, it might be unfair to just have a staffer, you know, an exhausted, overworked staffer trying to compare. So they actually said you can't reject ballots for not being, you know, the same or similar to what's on file.
But if an electronic, verifier, if you would, were doing it, would that change the story?
You know, anytime you want to bring in new technology or new systems into the election system, it's really complicated. There are always going to be problems where, you know, there are always going to be problems. There are always going to be places where things don't work perfectly. You know, this is one of those details that really has to be hammered out and really carefully thought through.
Okay. How does this proposed legislation treat ballot drop boxes, Jonathan Lai? I mean, Republicans at one point wanted to ban them. The state Supreme Court upheld their use, however, so they remain a factor in elections. But what does the legislation want to do with ballot drop boxes?
One of the big concerns that a lot of Republicans had with last year's election was this idea that things aren't uniform across the entire state, right? Counties run things differently. Because the thing we have to remember is, in Pennsylvania and all across the country, it's actually the counties that are running the elections. So when we talk about like the Pennsylvania election, we're talking about 67 counties running 67 elections at the same time. And so some counties had drop boxes, some counties didn't. And this legislation, it would propose creating minimums and maximums. So it would say every county has to have a mail ballot drop box. You can scale up one drop box per 100,000 residents. It maxes out at 10, which would be interesting because Philadelphia has 15 million, has 1.5 million people, sorry.
Yeah.
So it might have fewer people per Dropbox. And it would also require all these other things around it. Like, you would need to staff and man those Dropboxes. And you would need to have security cameras on the Dropboxes. So that means right now, where Dropboxes in the past year have been more like mailboxes,
sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. And it's just open around the clock, 24 hours. You just go and drop it in. Now they would be open for specific times on specific days. And there would be people there checking your voter ID and checking your mail envelope.
Almost like a mini poll place.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, there are some things in this legislation that would appeal to Democrats, likely appeal to Democrats. For instance, early in place, at the polls voting. Tell us about that.
That's right. This would create an in-person early voting period, which is one of those things that a lot of Democrats really support. We've seen it work well in other states, including Florida. And it's a popular idea that we shouldn't require voters to vote at a specific time on a specific day, right? That one specific Tuesday of election day. People have jobs, people have other obligations. And so this would allow for in-person early voting in which you can go to one of these centers and it's kind of like voting on election day. You can sign in on the poll books. You can either, depending on your county, just go vote on a machine or you get your ballot, you mark it right then and there. And it's very much in-person voting ahead of election day.
We're speaking with Jonathan Lai, data and democracy reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. about a piece of proposed legislation from House Republicans, which would, you know, make some, if enacted, some pretty significant changes to the state's election system. Also, Jonathan, there is a provision to allow counties to begin processing and counting mail-in ballots, also known as pre-canvassing, 5 days before Election Day. So are you a little surprised that this provision was included in the legislation?
You know, I'm not, because everybody has been clamoring for it for more than a year now. There's a real demand for what we call pre-canvassing, to begin processing the ballots, right? Checking for those signatures, checking them, opening the envelopes, unfolding the ballots. Even under this legislation, you can count the ballots before Election Day. We saw what happened last fall, right? Everybody was waiting for days and days, and it wasn't until the Saturday after Election Day that news organizations called the race, the presidential race for Joe Biden, after Philadelphia dropped some more ballots. It takes time to count millions of mail ballots. It really does. And pre-canvassing allows you to start the process earlier, with the idea that if you start earlier, you can finish earlier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I'm just asking that because of all the controversy about widespread mail-in balloting during the 2020 presidential election. So do you see bipartisanship on some of these factors in the bill, like pre-canvassing and like early voting at the polls?
You know, it's really hard to know, and the politics are very hard to predict, especially around election changes. Pre-canvassing was not one of those things that was super partisan, but it's certainly something that, from what I've seen, Republican legislators aren't super interested in, necessarily. It's something that they're willing to do. In fact, they proposed it last fall as well and tried to use it as a bargaining chip for other legislative changes.
Okay.
But it's not necessarily a thing where one side wants it and the other side opposes it.
Okay. The legislation, Jonathan, would also establish a Bureau of Election Audits. So as a partisan election audit continues in Maricopa County, Arizona, and, you know, and there are also calls from Trump Republicans to conduct one in Georgia, how do you read this? I mean, how might a Bureau of Election Audits play if, say, there were to be a close presidential race in Pennsylvania in 2024?
You know, I think we have to be really careful when we talk about election audits. You know, I think there are a lot of people who would say that what's happening in Arizona is not a nonpartisan best practice audit, and they're probably right. You know, what we have in Pennsylvania right now is a form of audit that is not really the best practice gold standard audit method. And so what would happen here is you would create, under the Auditor General's office, this election bureau, right? This election audit bureau. And it would be required to do a whole host of things. One of them is to do the kind of audits that we might be thinking about, where we're looking at a random sample of ballots and saying, were these accurately counted? Do the results, you know, do the reported results line up with what we have in our hands, right? Because every ballot, every vote cast in Pennsylvania now has a paper trail. And so we can compare the two and say, do these line up? Now, it would also do a whole bunch of other things, like track voter, you know, voting machines, track the number of voters across the state, look for problems. It would provide a lot of reports. So there's a lot going on there.
So it would ostensibly remain nonpartisan, hopefully, during a hotly contested race or election cycle?
You know, that's the idea. It's hard in Pennsylvania. Everything is partisan. You can put the Bureau of Election Audits under the State Auditor General's office. The State Auditor General is itself an elected position, right? Now, of course, in the year that the Auditor General would run, the Auditor General would have to assign somebody else to lead the audits. But, you know, everything is elected, everything is partisan. You know, even the Pennsylvania Department of State, Republicans last year and in the last few months have had a lot of criticism of it because it is a part of the Wolf administration. And
sure,
they say the department has always been acting in a democratic way, trying to, you know, be partisan. I don't know that that's obviously true. You know, there are a lot of times when that's not true at all. But it's very easy to claim partisanship and see it if you want.
Let's look at what's happening on the federal level. The U.S. Justice Department is now doubling down on its effort to fight efforts to limit ballot access and prosecute those who go after election workers, say. How much of an effect do you think, as an observer, this might have on GOP efforts to enact new laws that might, in effect, restrict voting?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to know. Because, again, counties are the ones who are actually running elections. And then the state legislature is setting rules above that. And then the federal government is setting rules above that. And, you know, the DOJ can do things. The state itself, right? The Attorney General's office can do things. It's really hard to know how everything interacts. And again, with this particular proposal, we have to keep in mind that it is subject to negotiation. It may not go anywhere. Wolf may not approve it.
Yeah.
It may come out in a very different format when it's negotiated, if it's negotiated. The Senate has not yet had its say. So it's very hard to make predictions this early on.
Okay, there's a long way to go. You know, in Pennsylvania, there is a governor's race next year. Governor Wolf's second term ends in January of 2023. He can't run for a third term. So if provisions of this bill don't pass muster, like the voter ID provision, do you expect Republican lawmakers to keep pushing on some of the more controversial provisions, you know, toward the hope, with an eye toward the hope that a Republican might be next to assume the governor's office?
I think that would be a very reasonable thing to assume. You know, I think we should always assume that everybody is, you know, looking out to the next few years and looking into the future. I would say that the 2022 race is, in fact, one of the big reasons for these kinds of changes to be a really hot topic right now, because you're right. We will have a new governor. We will also have a new senator. And that's going to draw a lot of national attention, right? We are going to be one of a handful of states that will be determining control of the Senate. And so everybody's going to be really interested in not only the actual races themselves, but just like last year, how are the elections run? Which ballots are we counting? How do people vote? Who can vote? Who can't vote? How difficult is it to vote? And that makes this moment really charged.
All right, stay tuned, right?
Absolutely.
Jonathan Lai, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan is data and democracy reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Just ahead, we'll talk with Dr. Joanna Berger of Rutgers University about the crisis threatening the red knot, a beloved shorebird that passes through the Delaware Bay during migration. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Recent news regarding the red knot is heartbreaking. Already listed as a threatened species, the number of red knots visiting the Delaware Bay during this year's spring migration dropped precipitously, a loss so big it surprised even the seasoned conservationists working to save the iconic shorebird. The red knot's spring migration can be a marathon from South America, the very tip of Argentina, Tierra del Fuego, north to the Canadian Arctic, with the stop along the Delaware Bay for crucial refueling on nutrient-rich horseshoe crab eggs. There are a number of factors, including the ongoing harvesting of horseshoe crabs, which have been endangering the red knot population for years. But some experts say the spring of 2021 has been so bad, the bird might be in danger of eventual extinction. Our guest for the rest of the hour is Joanna Berger, biology professor at Rutgers University and a behavioral ecologist whose work and research focuses on marine and coastal birds. Welcome, Joanna.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So there are people, Joanna, whose vocation it is to monitor the red knot population every spring when these birds stop by the Delaware Bay's beaches. You are among them. I know you work closely also with fellow biologist Lawrence Niles. Approximately how many red knots did you find this year?
This year, there were only between 6,000 and 7,000. It's hard to determine the exact number because some red knots arrive and then leave and others join them. But throughout the season, the number never got higher than 7,000. And that's incredible because in the early 1980s, when I first conducted the surveys there with a number of other people, there were 95,000.
My goodness.
A drop from 95,000 is huge.
Sorry for jumping in. I just couldn't help but just, I guess, exclaim at that drop, 95,000 to about 7,000. What were your thoughts this spring when that, you know, 7,000 was the final number or right around there?
It's hard to explain. It's really very sad to hold a bird that only weighs 100 grams when it arrives on the bay and have it leave 2 weeks later having almost doubled its weight, and to realize it has to go all the way to the Arctic and all the way back to South America and sometimes the southern tip of South America to complete its yearly breeding season. And for a bird who's been struggling like that for a number of years, and we've seen this drop from 95,000 to 6,000, it's absolutely heartbreaking. And we really need to do something about it because Delaware Bay is a funnel point. It's the place where much of the population on the East Coast comes through that bay each spring.
So before we get more into the forces working against the red knot, we'll do that in just a moment. You did tell our producer, Paige Murray Bessler, that Delaware is a node on the migration route. A great chunk of this is the timing by nature, you know, to coincide with the birds' stopover and the spawning of horseshoe crabs. What is it about the horseshoe crab egg that makes it such a tremendous refueling food? And why is the red knot so dependent on this one food source?
Because the horseshoe crab eggs are very easily digestible. They don't have a hard chitinous cover or any other kind of material that the birds would need before they can actually begin to use the energy. In a way, you can think of the difference between someone giving you just a broken open egg without the shell on, and you could eat that. But if they gave you the egg with the shell, or they gave you a clam, a small clam with the shell, it's harder to eat and digest that. So when the birds first arrive here, they are very, very stressed, and in some cases have started to partly digest their digestive tract. Mm. And they need to be able to have a very soft food that they can easily digest and get immediately into their bloodstream to give them energy. They have so short a period of time that they need this packed energy source that's easily digestible.
One of the ongoing problems has been the over-harvesting of the horseshoe crab population. New Jersey has banned it, but other states like Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia still allow horseshoe crabs to be taken for bait. If these states did agree to a moratorium on the gathering of horseshoe crabs, would this end up making a real impact on the rehabilitation of red knot populations?
Yes, it would clearly make a huge impact. And the reason is that unlike many other species, the red knots are really dependent upon the eggs of horseshoe crabs, and they're dependent upon them only for a short period of time. And at the moment, these eggs are really only available in Delaware Bay, and that's why it's a node, because Delaware Bay is kind of the center of horseshoe crab breeding along the East Coast. We have the largest numbers there. And at one time, presumably eons ago, horseshoe crabs were breeding in very dense numbers all along the East Coast, from Maine to Virginia. And that would have allowed, centuries ago, for species like red knots to be foraging in many different places. But at the moment, because of declines in horseshoe crabs, the birds are concentrated in Delaware Bay. And because the shorebirds are eating excess eggs, they're not eating horseshoe crab eggs that will ever hatch, because the horseshoe crabs lay them about 7 or 8 inches below the ground, and the birds cannot get them there. What the birds are eating is excess eggs that are washed up because some horseshoe crabs breed too close to the surf, and the increasing water of surf and storms washes up some of those eggs. So what the shorebirds need is excess eggs. So we need to increase the population of horseshoe crabs well beyond the number that's needed to maintain horseshoe crabs.
So what else contributed to making 2021 an especially bad year for the red knot, aside from, you know, the situation with horseshoe crabs?
The populations of red knots that started out, as we said, in about 95,000 had gotten down to 15,000 to 30,000 for a number of years in the 2003 to 2012, 14, 15 period. And they were alternating between 15,000, 20,000, 25,000, depend upon the year and the reproduction in the Arctic. But last year, unfortunately, there was cold weather early in the season, and the horseshoe crabs didn't come in to breed at the same time that they usually do. Horseshoe crabs don't breed until the water temperature is about 59 degrees. Like us, some things are dependent upon the temperature to happen. And so the horseshoe crabs didn't come in to breed until partway through what is the normal migration season of the red knots. And so last year, we believe one of the factors may be that the 15,000 or so birds that arrived in the bay last year didn't have enough food, and so they left. But when they left, they had two choices: to try to find horseshoe crab eggs in some other place, the New York Harbor or Cape Cod or some of those other places, or they had to fly the 3,000-4,000 miles to the north.
Wow.
That's a long ways to go on an empty stomach when you don't have energy resources. And so it is possible that the populations last year partly crashed between this year, last year and this year, because the birds weren't in a good enough shape last year to reach the Arctic. And what this points to is that this population is at the edge, and any small thing at this point can have a very great effect.
So even as we're trying to mitigate man-made obstacles, i.e. the over-harvesting of horseshoe crabs, you know, bird populations have to be at a healthy place because Mother Nature can throw them a curveball.
That's the problem, that over evolutionary time, red knots have adapted to a lot of, as you say, evolutionary curves on the part of nature. But when we reduce them to a point where they're at a very low level, then any kind of really severe environmental effect, particularly if it happens 2 years in a row. Now, the horseshoe crab eggs happened to be abundant this year, and the temperature was right, and there were a lot of eggs on the beach. But we're dealing with a population that has to survive from last year to this year in order to make use of those
and
eggs.
Recover, sure. It has to recover in its numbers. Joanna Berger, you say we need to take emergency measures. Get into that some more for us. What sorts of measures?
Horseshoe crabs are used basically for two things at the moment. They're used by fishermen as bait to get conch and eel and other things that we like to eat. And they're used by the medical industry to produce lysate. Now, the problem is that if we don't reduce what we can easily reduce fast and easily, the knots are going to be more and more trouble. And one of the quickest or easiest things that could be done is to put a moratorium on the taking of horseshoe crabs for bait right now. And to enforce that, if you would like, to enforce it for 3 or 4 or 5 years until we could show that the number of horseshoe crabs in Delaware Bay, but also along the East Coast, has increased.
Do you see that happening? I'm sorry for interrupting, but you know, this problem has been around for a while. New Jersey's on board. Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia are not at this point as far as these crabs being taken for bait. Do you see them hearing your message?
Well, I think they could hear the message, particularly about the populations that directly affect Delaware Bay, which is Maine, New Jersey, and going down to Virginia, that population. One could do, and one could reach the governor of Delaware to enforce or to pass similar laws in Delaware. It is a very tricky problem, and we have to work on all fronts. But the American public has had an effect in a number of ways when you think about how fast some measures have worked in the population. It's a matter of alerting the public that this really is a problem, that the knots really are in danger, and that in the 40 years since I've been working on them, they have never been as low as 6,000.
Is it possible that we might be talking about extinction eventually if significant measures aren't taken immediately soon to reverse the trend?
We would likely be talking or could be talking about extinction for the population that migrates all the way to Tierra del Fuego, okay, which is in the southern tip of South America, because they are the ones that most are at risk because they're most stressed. They have to fly the farthest distance in order to get back and forth between their breeding grounds and their wintering grounds. I never like to talk about extinction itself because usually bird populations can get very low and you still maintain some. But then if you have a severe environmental hazard or risk, then they could go extinct. Okay. But I'm not an alarmist that's going to say that. What I'm going to say is there are things that we can do, particularly if we get the public and environmental groups and the fishermen all together to figure out how to solve this problem. There is an artificial bait, and one of the things that could be done is to require that in some states and not allow the use of horseshoe crabs. The artificial bait has been shown to be as successful in catching things. It's a matter of economics and working out the economics and giving incentives to the people who need it for bait.
There, let's talk just briefly, because unfortunately we're up against the clock. You know, the pharmaceutical industry also, as you mentioned earlier, uses an extract from the horseshoe crab blood. There's an alternative to this. Some in the industry have embraced it, but the entire industry has not. I think, is it RFC? And so what is the situation there? Why is there reluctance among some entities in the pharmaceutical industry to just kind of go all over to RFC?
It's always about the money. It's always about who has patents and what it's going to cost to do these things. And I think that it's going to require a coordination between the agencies that manage horseshoe crabs, the agencies that manage the lysate industry, and encouragement for the pharmaceuticals to go completely to the artificial, which they could do. So in both cases, the cases of bait and the case of lysate, there is an economic alternative that could be used. It's a matter of encouragement and incentives and a public that's saying, you must do this. This is an important issue. And I think the thing to remember is that the state of New Jersey, Mandy Dye, is sort of the head of it from running the horseshoe crab and running the shorebird program. We are all working very hard on this program, but it takes a more national effort and the realization on the part of legislatures, administrators, and people who run pharmaceutical companies. It requires getting everyone together to look at the problem and to say, look, we have to solve this now. It is really dire when a bird goes from 95,000 to 6,000 in a particular place that it is always used.
So, Joanna,
it is a dire
Sorry. What sorts of numbers do you want to see next year from the red knot population that would be encouraging to you?
15 to 25,000.
You expect
population
that?
The population we've had for the last 10 years.
Do you expect to see that?
I'm worried that we won't see it because getting down to 6,000 is really lower than we've ever seen it. And it's a really heartbreaking situation because so many people have worked so hard to try to make this work, including putting it on the United States threatened species list.
Maybe we can end the conversation on something of a positive note. Miss Pillion Harbor in southern Delaware, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is now a permanently protected place. What might this mean in the fight to preserve the red knot?
It's a very important step, but there are more steps that need to be taken even in Delaware. Delaware could have a moratorium on the taking of horseshoe crabs, and that would help so that Miss Billion is not the only place in Delaware that the shorebirds concentrate. What we've tried to do in New Jersey is have many different beaches along Delaware Bay that they can feed and feed without any disturbance from people.
Joanna Berger, so glad to have you with us. Keep us posted. We're all rooting for a turnaround in the red knot population. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joanna Berger is biology professor at Rutgers University and a behavioral ecologist whose work and research focuses on marine and coastal birds. Our engineer today has been Al Banks, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening and be well.